Think about the things you said when you were younger. Did you ever utter phrases like, I'd never work for those people, or I could never reach a compromise with those people? People do say things like that, only to go back on those words later when life and its realities intrude. Does that make the people who go back on their words sellouts? Well, that is the broad question in a new book by Lily Zhang and Dr. Inga Hansen called The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. Lily Zhang is an organization consultant, executive coach, speaker, and author focused on creating healthy workplaces. Dr. Inga Hansen is a clinical psychologist, now the director of student well-being services at Stanford University, focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Dr. Inga Hansen is our guest. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
At the outset, it appears that both you and Lily are in the process of helping people work as their genuine selves, but it sounds like in that particular realm, you're finding people who just don't feel like they're being quite authentic.
Yeah, so Lily was first an activist, now a diversity consultant, as you mentioned, and I work as a therapist, among other things. And a lot of the stories we were both hearing was about this clash between what people thought they were supposed to be doing and what they were actually doing. I think we're often told, you know, to live according to our values, follow our moral compass, but then what happens if your needs and values are in conflict, or the values of your community clash with those of larger society, or what you need to do to get by?
So is it often about more money things, or is it sometimes loftier than that, where they're selling out their principles? I mean, are they keeping their principles intact, but they just do things for money?
Well, sometimes it's about money, you know, like trying to think about what a person needs to do to support their family or advance in terms of their career. Other stories that we heard from people had to do with their health. What do they need to do to actually survive physically? Or what they need to do to graduate from school. So it's all types of different situations that can lead a person into a place where they're questioning whether they need to compromise and how much in order to move forward.
My eyebrows certainly went up when I read the section of the book where you say that both you and Lily feel to some extent like you have sold out.
Yes. Yeah, so for myself, I identify as a queer woman and very much out. In fact, many aspects of my job have to do with serving the LGBTQ community, so it's very integrated into my identity and my professional life. And yet there's been situations where I found myself hesitating to be open about my identity, and not necessarily situations where, you know, my life was at stake or anything like that. But for instance, as a mother, dropping my kid off at school, interacting with other mothers or parents in our community, and having that moment before answering questions about my husband, you know, to say, oh, I actually don't have one. Am I going to say that, in fact, I date women? Or might that actually get in the way of play dates, acceptance of me and my family by the community here? And so then I wonder, am I just out and proud when it's convenient? Or am I actually making a choice that's in the best interest of my son?
Hmm. Well, when it gets to talking about ethics and trying to live your ideals, I wonder, particularly when it comes to situations like where you know, Lily was an activist and is now working within this system, that's an old question, isn't it? Whether you can affect change better by working within the system or working from without?
Yes, and I think there's no simple answer to that question, at least in my mind and my experience, right? Because on the one hand, sometimes you learn the system best by working within it, and you can have a voice for some of the change makers or the people who have the most power in order to start the ball rolling in a new direction. And then for other people, what can happen is you start working within the system and you're actually very influenced by the culture of the system and the goodies that can come with being part of a system. And it's easy to get influenced by that and kind of sucked in. It can be a lot of glitter and excitement and money and praise and so on. And sometimes, even despite our own best intentions, we can end up making decisions that were very different from the values we originally thought we would be able to hold on to.
You draw a line early in the book between ethical and unethical sellouts. And of course, the book is called The Ethical Sellout. Do examples abound?
Of being an ethical sellout?
Either one.
I think across the board, absolutely. One of the things that we found as we started speaking with people is that nearly everyone has a story of some kind of compromise around their values of selling out in some way. I think the ones that we hear about in the news or the media would be what I would tend to think of as the less ethical version. You know, the politician who goes back on campaign promises because of donations that are lining their pockets, or people signing record deals and then changing their original art or music. But then there's these other stories where people are making these decisions more out of survival than trying to gain something or get ahead. They're actually just trying to get by. And so that's a very different situation from what we typically hear about. And then the other part that we really try to bring out in this book, thinking about selling out ethically, is how these decisions are made. Often there's a lot of focus on what's being done, who's doing it and what's being done, rather than the how and the why. And so we really want to think also about what are some of the values in terms of, is honesty part of the equation? Is accountability part of the equation? These are some of the things that distinguish between selling out and doing so ethically.
Is this something that, I mean, I don't know, you didn't have a huge sample of the population, you talked to a few dozen people, but I mean, is this something a lot of people are faced with? I mean, some of us just, I don't know, just go to work and don't think about it, I think, don't we?
Well, I think that, again, we often pay attention to those big dramatic decisions, you know, and those are some of the ones that many people do face. Am I going to follow my passion and find meaningful work, or am I going to go for the money? Mm-hmm. These kind of things that get a lot of attention. But if we start thinking about it, often on a regular basis, we are faced with smaller decisions where there is a question of compromising our values in some way. And those are maybe the ones we don't always think about or conceptualize in terms of selling out, but I would still categorize them in that same general category. One of our stories, for instance, tells the story of Beth, whose heat wasn't working. And she decided to really, you know, play up one of her identities in order to endear herself to the repair person who had come into her home.
Hold the thought, if you would, Dr. Hansen. We need to take a short break. Back to talk more about the ethical sellout, maintaining your integrity in the age of compromise, with Dr. Inga Hansen on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Inga Hansen, a clinical psychologist who directs the Student Well-Being Services at Stanford University. She and partner Lily Zheng, she and writing partner Lily Zheng, have written a book about selling out and what it feels like to have to compromise something in order to get the things you need out of life. They propose an ethical sellout. That is the name of their book, The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. You can join our conversation on the Exchange, share an example with us, or suggest an approach to this. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. All right, so back to the story of Beth. Her heat was out, and she had to choose how to approach the people who could get the heat turned back on.
Yeah, so she noticed that the repair person was wearing a yarmulke, and she thought, well, maybe if he knew I was Jewish, then he'd be much more excited about helping me out with this. And she's half Jewish, but what she did was really play up that part of her identity and ignored the Catholic side of her identity. And so I think this is one of many examples where in the day-to-day, sometimes we'll highlight one part of ourselves, ignore or kind of cast away a little bit of some other part of ourselves, or we make decisions every day around what's convenient, what's too inconvenient, around the food we eat, the way that we live, where we live, the type of work that we do, and so on. And so those are maybe some of the smaller, less dramatic examples of selling out, but ones that really apply to all of us.
Yeah, that example of Beth leads me to think of the other situations in which you're talking to somebody, and it feels like you're having good rapport, and then they say something that makes you go, and you're in the situation like, well, do I tell them I completely disagree with them, or is this just a conversation we'll never have again? I won't see them again. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, Jeffrey, I think that's a great example. And again, one that I think that's probably happened to all of us at some point, where on the one hand, we could stand up for our values in that moment and really take a stance. And then sometimes we also have to think about what we're sacrificing, right? Is this somebody that we're going to need to be working with? Is it a client that we need to make a good impression with? Is it a potential friend? And so there's so many different things that can come into that equation in that split second, trying to decide how to respond.
Well, the actual first example in the book is of a rock and roll band that that got a record deal, got signed, but had to change their look to get fame and money. And as I read further into this, I thought, boy, this could be the Beatles. And sure enough, turns out it is.
Right. And so that was one of the stories that really struck me. And I think this was my overall experience was once you dig in, everybody has a sellout story. But one of the things that John Lennon talked about was once he got his band got famous enough that there was a manager, there started to be a lot more instruction about their stage presence, how they spoke, how they dressed, how they did their hair. They were told to really tone things down, look very wholesome, things like that. And he felt that his music was lost in some way and that it was a sellout experience for him.
Interesting. Did he feel like he'd gotten around to being the real him later in his career or without the Beatles?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Did he feel like he'd been his real true self after he was done with the Beatles?
Well, he just felt like the music died at that point. At least that's what he said in this Rolling Stone interview. And so I wonder if what he did later in his life was actually a search to reconnect with that authenticity. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he ever felt that he got back there completely.
Okay, and of course we can't ask John Lennon now.
Right.
You do get into definitions of sellout in the book. And let me ask for up front, is it ever viewed in a positive light?
Well, I think our society certainly doesn't view it in a positive light. What we're hoping to do, though, is to offer a more nuanced perspective of selling out. And most of us really hesitate to even use that label. It has such an extremely negative connotation. But on the other hand, if we're all doing it at some point, then we all need to find some way of reconciling with it and some framework to feel like it's not always a traitorous, terrible act. And so I can say, and sometimes maybe we need to acknowledge, even if we don't call it a good thing, it may be a necessary thing, it may be a human thing, and also something that can be done ethically.
Did the people you talk to often mention what the foregone alternative might have been? Like, what would have happened if they had stayed true to their values, to their moral compass?
They often did, although often it's complicated, right? It maybe is not always a situation where, oh, if I stayed true to my values, it would be this thing, but I diverged from that. Sometimes there's two different sets of values that the person is torn between. And other times, like you said, it's more clear, but most of our people, as they looked back, the stories that they told was that they didn't regret the decisions that they had made. They may have acknowledged that they felt that they sold out, but they also saw that if I hadn't, I might not have been able to survive, or I might not be where I am today. And in the end, the benefits outweighed the downside in terms of having compromised.
Did money, cost of living, lifestyle, were those often the reasons that people thought they had compromised?
Some of the time. I was surprised, actually, that it wasn't as frequent as an occurrence as I expected it to be. Both of us expected that we would see these decisions largely made by privileged people, people with money, people who are just trying to get ahead in some way in the world. And like I mentioned previously, it was much more of a survival decision. In some cases, it was a financial survival decision. Okay, I need this job in order to pay my expenses, or this type of work that's helpful for my mental health, and that also happens to be a job that is a little bit different from the type of work that I would be expecting to do. Other times, it was other things that were going on, like a person thinking about, okay, what does it mean if I am going to lose weight now after I've really reconciled and become comfortable and confident with an identity as a fat woman? What does it mean to give that up for health reasons? Now, that's not a financial question at all, but it does mean sacrificing something that was previously so central and held dear, and really gets to the core of a person's identity and who they believed they were up to that point.
I do want to ask about Sophie's story just a bit later on. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Dr. Inga Hansen from Stanford University. She and Lily Zhang wrote the book, The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. Let's get into some concepts you offer here. One is called the impossible choice. The other is called the moral smoke detector. Can you flesh those out for us?
Sure. So The impossible choice is really our attempt to name the situation that a person often finds themselves in when they're pulled in two directions, right? If there's values on the one hand and needs on the other, or this set of values in competition with this set of values. And what we're trying to highlight there is how difficult these choices can really be. For instance, if you are doing some groundbreaking research and then you find out that the organization funding the research has white supremacist ties, and you're pulled between, oh, this research really needs to move forward, and yet I don't want to be supporting this organization that I really, really feel strongly against. So that's an example of an impossible choice.
And how about the moral smoke detector?
The moral smoke detector is our way of talking about the signal that we get in our own mind when we've done something that goes against our value system. And one of the reasons that we use the example of a smoke detector is that smoke detectors aren't terribly nuanced. They just let us know when something's off. Sometimes they're beeping for no reason. Sometimes they are beeping, but we're not really sure what was the thing that specifically was the issue. And I think that that can work with our conscience also, where we can have an uncomfortable feeling after having made a decision, especially an impossible choice, but it's not always clear immediately whether we actually did something wrong, something that was out of line with our values, what we actually need to do about it to make it better. We can just tell that there's something off.
Huh. Okay, interesting concepts, the impossible choice and the moral smoke detector. Now, you get into six skills that are key, you say, you and Lily, to sell out ethically. Compassion, honesty, accountability, nuance, growth, and exploration. And what do you know, you get an acronym out of it.
Yeah, so those words spell out change, which Lily, thanks to her, was spent some time on thesaurus.com trying to get there, and happily we did. Yes, and so what we're looking at there are skill sets that all of us have. We're not talking about something that's brand new there, but really what we're hoping to do is help people think about how these skill sets can be used together when they're in a situation with an impossible choice. For instance, how can you be compassionate both with yourself and with other people involved in the situation? It's so easy to get self-blaming or shaming when we're in a situation where we might be compromising. But then at the same time, also being really honest with ourselves about the motivations behind a choice, and not just why we like to think we've made the choice, but why we're really making it, because you need to be honest in order to then be accountable and to own your decision and the impacts it may have, which may not always be positive, and then being able to make it right if necessary.
Now, a lot of these speak for themselves: compassion, honesty, accountability, growth, exploration. Nuance doesn't necessarily present itself very clearly in the beginning, but it wouldn't be nuanced if it weren't nuanced, right?
Right. And I actually feel like this is one of the most important skills, especially in this day and age, because it's so easy for us to think in black and white. We're so politically polarized right now, and so many of us are pulled in these situations where, you know, I'm right, this person's wrong, I'm wrong, this is right. And actually what we're really trying to encourage is the nuance within a situation, moving outside of what some people call purity politics, and this sense that there's a perfect way to be a black person, a Democrat, a liberal, a conservative, and so on, and more into we're all a mix of fantastic and not so fantastic decisions and great and lesser great qualities, and that decisions are similar, and that some of our choices actually have a lot of gray area within them, and we're better decision makers if we're able to see that gray area and work within it rather than pretending to ourselves that there's a perfect solution to each problem.
Ah, that is a big one then, not to suddenly go, ah, I'm a sellout, I did this all wrong, and you know, give yourself a little room for some fudging there.
Right, right. And one of the examples that I talk about is a client of mine who made a mistake, right? He is in a marriage and he had an affair. And he, at first, he was trying to deny it and kind of keep himself on one side of avoiding nuance, which is, I'm right, she was wrong, she didn't give me what I needed, and that's why I needed to have an affair. But then as soon as he realized the impact of what he'd done, he just drowned in guilt, which was actually equally unhelpful, right? As soon as he saw himself as completely bad and without redemption, then there was no going back from that either. And so being able to see ourselves as essentially good people who sometimes make poor choices is what allows for the growth that can come next.
Okay. Nuance is indeed a big part of the change, again, is the acronym Compassion, Honesty, Accountability, Nuance, Growth, Exploration. Dr. Inga Hansen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Lily Zheng of The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. You can join this conversation on the Exchange. Share stories. Do you feel like you sold out on something or have questions for the doctor about the approach? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jacob in Springfield. Welcome.
I wanted to hear about your experiences advising students at Stanford. I heard this interesting statistic a few years ago, that the number one major for undergraduate women at Stanford is now computer science or electrical engineering and software programming along those lines, when probably classically, as any great classic liberal comprehensive university, it probably used to be like literature or psychology or language studies or a lot of other things that I think women tend to be more collaborative and social. And the problem I saw with the software and studies and stuff is that they're kind of soul draining. But the problem with Stanford is it had a dump truck full of money backed up into its backyard with, you know, Facebook and YouTube and
all the tech money,
you know, Microsoft and Apple. And so everyone sees the draw of Stanford is Silicon Valley and all and the potential to become the next billionaire. But how are these women coping with, you know, computer science, you know, degrees and you know, their choices that a few of them may regret later in their lives?
All right. It's an excellent question. Thanks for that, Jacob.
So I think what you're talking about feels very real here. There is a siren call into tech industries. We see it around us. We see the billionaires next door. And our students are pulled into that for many reasons, right? Like the financial security, the excitement, family pressure, and a genuine interest in those fields. One of the things that I'm seeing, though, is this growing tension between more of the tech or STEM side for students and then what we would call the fuzzy side, which is more of the traditional liberal arts education. And I get concerned when students might be following a path that's not genuinely theirs or not genuinely their passion because it provides that financial security and then what that means for them in the long run. And one of the things that Stanford's in some ways still really striving to do is to emphasize the value of a liberal arts education, even for CS majors, that it's really important to be well-rounded and to explore these other areas of one's life and maybe not to decide too early that one is going to go into a specific career. And I think that's vital.
So do they talk in terms of changing the tech industry? You know, if they find it soul-sucking, maybe it has something to do with the people who run the business now. And maybe, like Jacob talks about, if they could use their natural collaborative skills to turn it into something other than what it has been deemed to be so far.
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think that many of us have different ideas about what the answer should be. So people within the tech industry or going into the tech industry are often talking about tech finding those solutions. So how can we use technology to improve mental health, improve compassion, improve the way that we speak to each other, and so on. And then at the same time, there's people here outside of the tech industry who are talking about tech is the problem, not the solution, and actually what we need is less technology in our lives altogether. And so that goes even beyond what industry we're going into, but the fact that we spend so much time on our phones and that many of our conversations happen via text these days and the ways that we're all influenced in terms of our mental health and our being by social media and so on. So it's a pretty lively debate right here. But in terms of my personal role, one of the things that I really try to do is help the students, especially who are in CS, as you say, or electrical engineering, to focus on their well-being in the other areas of their lives and not just become, you know, walking robots that are only focused on this one particular area and this one form of success.
Well, and it's interesting because as we're talking about this, I'm looking at my next question, which was about the fact that you say that there's a tendency to believe we are alone when we grapple with these dilemmas. And in fact, it seems like people are often surprised, as they are with many things that challenge them in their lives, to find out that other people are feeling the exact same thing.
Yes, Jeffrey, and I think that's actually one of the reasons that we were so inspired to write this book, was that so many people feel like they're alone with these decisions, and actually it feels like it's a situation that nearly everybody struggles with at some point. One of the concepts that we talk about is, it's called pluralistic ignorance, which it's a social psychology concept, which is this idea that there's a norm that privately almost everybody is going against or violating or feels uncomfortable in some way, but publicly everybody is going along with it. And I feel like selling out in general fits in that category, where we're all saying, oh, I would never do that, and I live a values-driven life, and I wouldn't want to compromise in that way. And privately, we're just torn up because we're thinking, oh, but actually, am I a sellout? Was that actually a selfish decision that I just made? Was that okay? And then we think we're the only ones who are struggling with it.
And what do you know, we're not, which is part of the reason the book is here. It's called The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. Lily Zheng and Inga Hansen are the authors. Dr. Inga Hansen will join us back here on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Inga Hansen, a clinical psychologist who is the director of student well-being services at Stanford University. She focuses on diversity, equity, inclusion, helps people figure out what they're doing with their lives, and finds people, not just through the job but elsewhere, who are concerned that they are selling out, that they have compromised their values or their principles in order to get things in life that they didn't think they maybe wanted before. She and Lily Zheng wrote a book together called The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the exchange. The phone number is 800-838-3760. Share your story, ask a question. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking earlier, Inga, about John Lennon and how he felt like the music died when the Beatles had to start wearing the matching suits and getting the cute haircuts and all that stuff. And Napoleon, no town given, wrote, "Ever listen to Plastic Ono Band?" He definitely got back there.
Oh, well, I'm glad that he found his own way back. I think what I couldn't speak to was just whether he felt like he had. But I still respect people being able to treat this as a continuing conversation and continual process. And I think that really touches on this idea of growth and exploration, right? That we might make a decision that we don't feel good about, and then we still have more chances to think about how we want to continue to live that out moving forward. And so perhaps John Lennon's a wonderful example of that.
Well, it would seem like, as a psychologist, you probably run across this a lot, people thinking that once they go down a certain road, there's no way back, that they can't make a decision again later to change back to the original path.
Absolutely. And one of the things I try to do in that situation is push back against that belief, right? Because that's where we get stuck. If we think we're unredeemable or that there's no way out, then we don't really have, we've taken away our own options at that point. And so then thinking about helping a person to understand, well, what are some of the reasons you made this decision, right? What's part of the context? What was the situation in which you made it? And whether you feel good about it or not, or feel like there was another choice or not, helping to view it with compassion and then think about what options they have moving forward. And sometimes that's actually to make a reparation in some case for what they've done in the past that they feel like has done harm.
Let's take another call here. We have Karen in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Inga Hansen.
Hello. I'm concerned that it just seems sad that we're so focused on the judgmental part of this selling out and all this, when I mean, you learn the greatest lessons when you go different directions. Like, in, you know, inventors always say, oh, I learned all this from my mistakes. And Mark Twain has a great story about leadeth into temptation, about a town that was so righteous. And that's the other side of this, is that when we're thinking that we're only following our moral convictions, that we get this holier-than-thou kind of attitude. And I just think life should be more a learning process instead of judging whether this is right or wrong morally or not moral, or just the learning.
Mm-hmm. You live, you learn. Thank you for that. What do you think, Dr. Hansen?
I really appreciate that outlook, and I hope that that's an outlook that we can spread. I think sometimes it's important to move outside of our comfort zone in the decisions that we make. And sometimes if we're too set on following a very specific moral code, we actually lose out on opportunities to grow and explore and learn from our experiences. And it is a tremendous growth opportunity when you do something and it doesn't feel right afterwards, or it feels different from your usual, and you can reflect on it and see how it fits with your overall value system. And that's some of the ways that I think we continue to refine our value system over time.
I haven't gotten to some of the major examples in the book yet, and that's what we can do with the last 10 minutes here. One of the stories is of a woman with body image issues. Sophie felt weird about gastric bypass surgery. Why?
An interesting story. She has been fat, self-identified as fat, her entire life since she was a child. And throughout her life, she heard a lot of negative messages around that, right? Where we live in a pretty fat-phobic society, right? And so not only her family, but multiple people in her life, doctors were always telling her that she needed to lose weight, she would never be attractive, she'd never find a partner, and she would just be a failure in so many ways if she wasn't able to get thin. And college changed things for her. She got to a place that people actually accepted her body for what it was. She found that she could exercise and be active and still be fat and still date and have a love life and so on. And it felt like this really hard-won self-acceptance that she had gotten to when she felt like, okay, I'm a proud fat woman. And really just at the point that she had reached that sense of peace with her identity, she was told that there would be some really serious health consequences unless she lost a lot of weight. So that was where the gastric bypass question came in. Her doctor suggested it, and she felt really torn. If I do this, what does it mean that I'm giving up this identity? What does it mean to still identify as a fat woman but maybe not be fat anymore? And am I taking an easy way out by getting a gastric bypass instead of taking other measures to get healthier, lose weight?
And then in the other case right after it is Julia, who had a progressive disability, and she struggled with a decision.
Yes, and so we put those two stories together because I really saw a parallel thematically between those two. Julia also had this journey of self-acceptance. She has a fairly severe disability. It's progressive, as you said, so it got more severe throughout her life. And also for her in college, she got to a point that she recognized that she moved away from this medical model of disability as, oh, I should apologize for the burden that I am to society, and more, why doesn't society have more accommodations? Why is society not more friendly to people with disabilities? And she became this really powerful disability advocate. It was central to her identity and her community. And just at that point, it was getting harder and harder to function and to work through graduate school and move forward. And then the FDA approved a treatment that would not only stop the progression of her disability, but reverse it to some degree. And so she, too, was torn. You know, if she took the treatment, then she'd be able to complete grad school, live much longer, have much more of independence in her life. But then was she saying that she was all for disability rights until there was an alternative option? Was she actually just doing what was convenient? Was she forsaking her community? So she also found herself in a real dilemma.
Did Julia and Sophie feel action? Did they get actual flack from the people in the communities they felt they might be abandoning? Or was this a lot of it internal pressure that they perceived would be the reactions of people in their communities?
they were both surprised to find out that their communities were extremely supportive of their decisions. And so Sophie's friends and community really rallied around her with getting the surgery. And one of the things that was most important to her actually was to maintain community with other people who identified as fat and who had gotten the gastric bypass, who understood what it meant to go through this process and to feel like they've walked through a door that they can't go back on in terms of identity. And Julia received some of the most support from other people in disability community, and they said, you know, it's not worth it to martyr yourself for the cause. How much are you going to do in terms of making a difference in the world by refusing this treatment versus what you can do with the treatment? And so she was so heartened to get that support.
So now we move into, you know, deeper communities of identity. Tanisha is the story you give. She's African-American and Latina, and she made a choice about how she would identify herself by name. Based on what?
So Tanisha was very aware of racism in our society and the ways that there can be prejudice even before meeting somebody based on a name, especially what she called a ghetto-sounding name, assumption of a person's racial identity. And so she was starting a PR business, and she thought, I don't want anything to get in my way. And so she decided to go by a different name. She felt Tanisha would be a problem for her professionally. So she'd opted to go by her middle name, Dariana, instead.
And did the benefits of Dariana, being Dariana, come even close to what she presumed they would be?
Not at all. Interestingly, she stuck with that name for 6 years, so quite a while. But what she found is that her friends never quite accepted it. They kept messing up, maybe purposely, maybe not, and calling her by her old name. Her business didn't really take off the way that she had hoped. And then she was giving a talk one day on authenticity and realized that she wasn't living an authentic life herself. She was going by a name that actually didn't feel right to her. And so she decided she would go back to her original name, Tanisha, and if people didn't want to engage with her in the business due to her name or her racial identity, she didn't want them as clients.
Well, and this gets into the whole realm of code switching, you know, where people will be one way with their home group and be differently outside of that home group. Who does it and why, usually?
Well, in some ways, we all do it. And what I mean by that is that we often shift the way that we talk, or even our body language, the language that we use, how we come across, or how we present ourselves physically, depending on whether we're, you know, in a work situation, talking to a toddler, talking to somebody who's from a different background as ours or our own background, and so on. But code switching particularly comes up for people with marginalized identities. I think the term has come up especially in terms of thinking about racial marginalization. And how, for instance, if you're Black, the language that you use and the way you put yourself across might really need to shift when you're with your community, with your family or other people of color or Black people, versus if you're in a white majority workplace that's expecting you to perhaps straighten your hair and talk in a more quote-unquote white kind of way, use a certain type of language, and you might feel like that's necessary to get by, to be taken seriously, and so on.
When you talk to people who have done code switching, do they tell you that they feel different in different settings? Do they still feel like they're themselves?
I think a lot of people feel like there's an extra layer that they're putting on in a code switching situation that's less themselves, that feels like there's a bit of effort and that they're a bit more careful and rather than relaxed in those situations. Other people sometimes see it differently. I've also heard people say, these are all aspects of myself, and I'm just highlighting different areas of my own being, and I'm flexing based on the situation. But I think it's important to acknowledge the discomfort that can sometimes go with it and the exhaustion at the end of a day when a person's really needing to code switch frequently.
So you what about people of mixed race or religion? You already mentioned Beth, who was both Jewish and Catholic and played up the Jewish side and trying to get her heat turned back on. You have some examples other than that in the book. I mean, how do they handle their different sets of identities within separate communities?
Well, I think that can be a particular challenge if you're holding these multiple identities, right? And I think there can also be some questions around feeling like a full-fledged member of either community, right? And so if a person has a mixed racial background, for instance, if they're Black and white, they might be experiencing themselves as held with a bit of skepticism, both amongst Black communities and white communities. And so that's an extra thing that they're holding. And sometimes the communities themselves are not fully trusting of the person because the Black community might experience the mixed race person as holding more privilege. They have lighter skin. Maybe they're able to move more smoothly and easily in white communities. And then yet white communities are still treating them as a person of color. And so I think there can be this added layer of self-consciousness for a person with mixed racial identity or mixed any identity around what part of their identity to highlight in a given situation, and what does it mean if you're consciously highlighting different identities based on the context that you're in.
Ultimately, do you and Lily get to a point of advocating that people relax a bit, don't be quite so hard on themselves, and realize that sometimes you're going to have to walk back your values just a little bit to get things done in life?
That is where we ultimately landed, although that's not at all to say that all selling out is okay or that selling out is good in general, but more we're trying to acknowledge the reality. And part of the reality is that some of the people who are hardest on themselves or struggle most with selling out decisions are people with marginalized identities, right? People of color, LGBTQ folks, people with disabilities, with marginalized faith backgrounds, women, so on. And these people can be the hardest on themselves also about the decisions that they make. So part of what we're wanting to do is acknowledge the pull between your smaller community, which may be expecting one thing from you, and larger society, which may be demanding another. And we're really hoping to give people tools for those situations and also to encourage compassion.
It is a really thought-provoking book. It is called The Ethical Sellout, Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. It's the work of Lily Zheng and Dr. Inga Hansen. Inga Hansen's been our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. Check us out on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is what you'll hear after As It Was. In the evening, it's As It Was, followed by news from the BBC. This program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange. Stay dry and have a great day.